So the question is about anatta. Well, that's at least how it started. And the sharing is about feeling despair and thinking about the state of the place that we are in, and then believing in it. But then there's another part who does not believe in it, right? And
yes, okay, the question is clear. Question is clear. Yeah, who is the one who knows? Yes, yes. And that's a very good question concerning anatta, because somehow we have the feeling that it is an I who decides and an I who knows. And you think, and that's your conclusion maybe, or the question also, if there is a knowing, there must be an I. If there is a... yes, exactly. If there is a knowing, there must be a knower. And that's a hypothesis. That's not a logical conclusion. If there is a knowing, there must be a knower. If there is a walking, there must be a walker. If there is a seeing, there must be a seer. If there is a decision, there must be a decider. This is confusing the issue. Actually, see if there is a walker, a seer, a decider, a knower. You know, this is exactly the point that we have to investigate to come to an understanding of what really is this dynamic anatta that knows. The non-self is actually a very dynamic process of lots of forces in action. First of all, many forces that aid understanding, which none of them have solidity, none of them have a center. So there is a centerless knowing. And that's an incredible thing, because I corrected myself. Remember when I talked that somehow that I found the solution. I corrected myself when I said that, because it's not true. It's not how the process happens. The process happens by different views, different aspects of the issue appearing in mind until there is a much more complete understanding arising, and it was not someone doing it. And this is interesting. So to round up the question, the modern psychotherapy talks of a self, right? But the modern psychotherapy doesn't talk of a stable self. There is no stable individual self. There is a learning self-process. There is a learning, constantly changing process of evolution, of interaction, interbeing, and so on. And yes, if you want to use that term for yourself, it's very fine. It's a constantly changing dynamic process. And that's what the Buddha happily referred to when he said, yes, I will come tomorrow for the meal. He used the word I in this understanding that all of these are dynamic processes without a center. And this is what we mean by anatta. And this is the jnana, the, you know, this timeless awareness that I was talking, or that the Mahamudra is talking about. The rigpa, this awareness we are talking about. That is this dynamic knowing that has no knower. And that's very interesting. When that becomes clear, what a relief. And so I wish for everybody that this becomes very, very clear. Then we go to the next question. There is you two, and you decide who goes ahead. You lifted your hand, you know, both of you.
About, maybe, on this. We know that we sometimes there is a conflict of interest between the individual's interest and ours. Like yesterday.
Yes.
And can we also, if you're human, someone comes to my house to kill me? What is the traditional view of that situation? What are the considerations how to behave?
Yes, you ask for the traditional view, and that view is traditionally one that will try to look into the situation and try to find out with the finest of one's abilities what would be the least harmful. Yeah, what? So, that is really difficult. You know, we had already, and when I was teaching in Brazil, we had termites walking into the meditation house, you know, eating up, starting to eat up the wood. You have to immediately act. We had a nest of wasps in front of the entrance of our retreat house in Germany. And often you cannot avoid to harm. Yes, you cannot avoid, but you try your best to find the better solutions. Yes? So there is no traditional answer of what you do when someone enters the house and wants to kill you and your family. There is no traditional answer which says you should do this or you should do that. Think for yourself and for others, and think also long term. So, for example, if it only concerns me, yes, if it only concerns me and I don't have a family and kids to protect, yes, then it's easier. But as soon as more people are involved, it's really difficult. And I've heard Tibetan masters say, we shouldn't have let the Chinese invade Tibet. It would rather have been better to stand on the mountain passes because there was no place to land with planes in Tibet. The invasion of Tibet happened over 7-8 years, you know. And some Tibetan great masters said, would have been better to fight off on the mountain passes instead of having so many people killed. You know, so there's always like this very terrible looking at the situations. And others said, and this has happened also very often, you know, like the Chinese, they would sometimes ask in the monasteries, which they put to the ground, and then they would ask, give the gun to a monk and say, you shoot this person, and then you will feel like they wanted to shoot the abbot. And and also that the chief people would be out of the way. And then many shot themselves instead of shooting someone. Yes? So the decision, what they would be reflecting on is, how is it better to leave my life? Is it better to leave my life having killed someone else, or is it better to leave the life having killed myself? How do I want to continue? Some were shooting in the air, then they were shot by, you know, and different solutions. So there is not one answer. And I still don't have an answer for, you know, like in Germany, the big discussion is now fear of the Russians, you know, and again, shall we have a big army again? Shall we, you know, able to defend ourselves? Because we are not even able to defend ourselves right now. So there's a big discussion and I don't have an answer. Is it better not to be armed? Is it better to be armed? Under which conditions are we going to use our arms? And so on. Yeah, all of those very difficult reflections we use to the best of our ability. We use our understanding to come to solutions which create the least harm. So, of course, the best solution would be peaceful coexistence, right? Or living together, that would be the best. But we are a long way away from that in some areas of this globe. Yes, definitely the best solution. So how can we get there? That is our compassionate wisdom looking for the answers. And this answer is not ready-made. It's not written somewhere. You know, we can't just pretend that Gandhi today would know what to do. You know, it's not like that. It was a specific situation, and a peaceful march can also be shot down. You know, it's not said that this will always win. You know, it's not said. It's not clear. So we have to use the best of our abilities. I myself, my life has been very clear in this, that to protect my own life, I wouldn't kill another person. But if you ask the question, then suddenly I'm surrounded by people that are going to be shot as well, or I have to witness atrocious terror and torture. You know, I know my emotions and my impulses will get so strong. I don't know if I can handle that. Yes. So no clear answer, sorry to say, but the idea how to reflect is very clear. For if I take a more easy example, like agriculture. So the way we treat the earth, the way we practice agriculture, that is a way which is more respectful to insects and the other life, and a less respectful way. So Dharma would always go to the more respectful way, definitely. The direction is very clear, always to that which is creating less harm, you know, less taking of life, more fruitful for everybody, yeah, like this. The direction is clear, but how do we get there? It's not so easy. Okay. Ah, yeah. Ah, yes. A brief explosive presence of the Buddhas in your pause, and then it fades away quickly. And it could be more sustainable, but our teachers, they always say, hey, don't try to artificially sustain it. Actually, this will create so much effort and it will make it artificial. But what you can do is you can let it reappear for another instant. The word for instant, for the moment, is ke in Tibetan, and chik means one. So they call this kechik-kechik visualization. One instant, one instant. So let your visualizations appear and disappear, appear and disappear. And that might at some time then get more stable. It might last for longer. But actually, that's not the aim, because the aim is that we touch that experience, that we touch that feeling. And the feeling might stay longer than the visualization. Yeah, the feeling of that openness and that, yeah, that presence and that feeling, wow, in this incredibly wide, easy awareness. So that is the important thing, not to have the Buddhas in every pore. And this now, what I answer to you, you can apply to all visualizations. This is an answer good for all. Yeah? Okay. Yes, you said that. Yes. You're concerned about the sheep shamatha. Yes, you understood that already a few years ago. Yes. Yes.
besides these factors, takes vitalizing and health, are there other practices? And how can I know or instruct people that I'm instructing in meditation?
Yeah.
How can I see or instruct them in that way to make sure that they are not doing
it? Yes. In my answer will be the question. Huh? Don't worry if you didn't hear. So in order to find out whether I'm in this slightly dull shamatha, which was called sheep shamatha, you know, this slightly dull or darkish shamatha has a bubble feeling to it. So you will see whether you are entering a bubble in these periods of meditation. And you know how it feels with a bubble. The difference, you know, when you're in a bubble, you always have a difficulty to get out. And so there is a transition difficulty. Like if you were the father and your child was running into the room where you're meditating, there would be a little bit anger, defensiveness, or maybe you don't even hear, you don't react, or your wife wants to tell you something. You know, there is like, you know that you have been in the bubble. There is a little defensiveness and a little clinging, and that makes the bubble. So you find out about that, and that is a pleasing feeling to it that wants to maintain. So there is a little aversion to more dynamic experiences. Okay, that is how you find out that you are in this kind of meditation. And then how to get out? Yes, there are many, many possibilities. The most simple is, for example, to look up, to allow for more light, to open also the other senses, to make a little movement with, for example, the head or with the body too. And when I was in there, my mind had become deeply non-conceptual. So my teacher asked me to bring in thoughts, to stimulate the active mind so that I would not be just in the calm, non-conceptual mind. So I had to overcome my aversion to thoughts, which was sign of my bubble. Yes, so there's so many things. You can straighten up the body a little bit. You disturb a little bit. A little bit, you know, like piercing the bubble. Piercing a little bit. Not too much. Doesn't have to hurt. Just a little bit more natural. Actually, the bubble is not natural. And I notice my bubbles. They tend to construct themselves quite quickly. The moment I have a fantastic luminosity, might come in already a stabilizing activity to stabilize that, to hold the way I'm looking, to hold the way of the luminosity. And immediately, there needs to be a recognition of that wish to stabilize. And normally, then, because you know, it already opens. There is not need for much connection there. Yes. And did you see who else was? Maybe back there. Yes, I take the lady at the pillar and under the here in the blue also. Yeah, you were there before. Yes. When you let go, you feel it very physical. Bubbling electricity. It is so physical that you're afraid to let go more because you might not exist. Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Now I think I get you. I will repeat your last words in the answer. When you let go, if I understand properly, then you have these strong electric flows, vibrating, pulsating. And actually, that's a sign that you're letting go is already releasing some prana. Yes? So what you need to do is you need to stay in this dimension of relaxation until you're familiar. It takes a while. You know, all these prana phenomena, they need to kind of work themselves out. They do that by themselves. And then again, and you will probably at every stage until long time in the process, you will have these prana phenomena, this energetic phenomena. And I want to give a little some advice for you and everyone else here in the room on the way. The prana phenomena are strongest before the actual letting go. They build up a little, and this is where you might feel your fear also. And if then you're able to let go, there will be a more harmonious flow for a while until the prana flow hits against the next knots, the next hindrances. Yeah. So the build up of these experiences is actually the sign that energy is slightly blocked and cannot flow so freely. That's why you have such strong experiences. And then as you're able to relax into it, then there will be for a while a more harmonious flow. But does it make sense to you? Maybe you thought maybe it's related to trauma in the body. That is very true, but trauma is a too strong a word. Some of it you could actually call trauma, but all our karmic imprints are related to vedanas, to sensations in the body, in the energy system. So whatever karma it is, it will manifest through the body. It will show itself in our energetic experience. It doesn't need to be a trauma. It can be, that's the strongest form, but it can also be, it can be more subtle experiences, maybe in the direction of what we call nowadays emotional trauma or repeated difficult emotional experiences that have left strong traces. You know, like if we have been afraid often, then we have typical knots in our energy channels, if we use that language. Okay, yes. 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 I repeat for the recording. It is well known that our clarity, luminosity is influenced by many additional factors like eating, the medicines we take, physical constitution, and so on. What I can say to this? Well, basically, the enhancing of the clarity using these outer conditions is very much like what they call a sattvic lifestyle in the yoga tradition. Yes, maybe that you know what that is meant. It's like you can increase clarity by eating lighter food, you know, a certain form of diet. But watch out. This is of course, clarity is usually enhanced if the temperature is cooler, then clarity becomes more. If temperature is hot, then, you know, all of this has an effect. A more straight sitting posture enhances clarity. More crooked posture or lying posture is not so much enhancing. All of that is very true, and you can use this. Yeah, you can use this, and you can try in your life to abstain from substances and ways of living your life that reduce your clarity. But then, the clarity we are talking about is an inherent clarity that is not dependent, not really dependent on these outer conditions. The real clarity and luminosity that we are talking about, the strongest experience of that, the most surprising experience, is in deep sleep. In deep sleep, when normal people are just unconscious, the yogi or yogini experiences the ground luminosity, a clarity that is always there, independent of conditions. And that's the luminosity, the clarity we go through at the time of death, of leaving this body, and so on. So basically working with the outer or the more obvious clarity and luminosity will help us to get used to being clear and luminous, and being used to this clarity and luminosity, even when resting the mind, we are still enjoying the luminosity. We are still, and we are not leaving that ground clarity. While for normal people, actually, there is too much clarity. They don't want so much. So they rather take a little beer, a steak, and sit on it. Yes. So too much clarity is not so welcome. Yes, so we can change that with the outer conditions, and then we always become more fine and look for that clarity actually within torpor, within somnolence. Oh, it was for me a great discovery when I noticed, I, of course, thanks to the instructions, that when becoming really, really tired in meditation, somnolence, you know, then to allow for it. And inwardly, while becoming so heavy that the head was sinking down, you know, that inwardly there was a very clear presence noticing how all the senses shut down, and there's only the feeling of the body then, and then you discover that the clarity continues as you're almost touching ground, you know. And that is that. These are beautiful discoveries in the state of greatest somnolence to find that there is an inner clarity, and so we go in that direction. I want to encourage you in that direction, but please don't try it all on me now. Here in the meditation hall, I will get if I see everybody trying this, you know, I will be full of despair, you know. But maybe at some point I will really ask you to lie down and we will do lying meditation and so on. The point has not come yet, but it's possible. It can happen. Yes? Please help me. Did you see which fingers were up? Asaf. Joyful perseverance in the paramitas, the fourth one. Yes, the virya.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, Asaf, yes, you want to know about this paramita, the fourth paramita of joyful perseverance, which is virya, energy in the original word, yes? And, well, for me it was easy to find out about that it is not just perseverance, because perseverance, you know, well, it sounds like a lot of effort, right? And when I looked into the definitions, fortunately, these Buddhist masters of old, they have definitions for every word they use. So when you look into the definition for that which is virya in Sanskrit and Pali and sundu in Tibetan, then you see that it is that special capacity to overcome hindrances through the joy of through the original joy of being linked to the wholesomeness of what you are doing. So it is the original joy with which you start, for example, meditation, but you might be in a Dharma project. You might have a project which is really good for many people, and there is a joy in the vision of that project. There's a joy in the wholesomeness. And if you always connect to that joy, then you will have this effortless perseverance that overcomes the obstacles, because it's the joy itself that gives you the energy. Yeah, the energy comes from the wholesomeness of that what you are doing. That's why it's a paramita, because it's directly connected to that which liberates. It's the joy in practicing or doing that which helps liberation, and of course it becomes a paramita because it is a selfless. It's not coming from this the illusion of a self. So I'm referring to definitions that are found in the Mahayana Abhidhamma. I haven't cross-checked with Pali Abhidhamma, but you can do that, and hopefully you will find, normally we find the same definitions, they don't usually vary. So it's much better to translate that as energy, and if you translate as perseverance, because that's the overcoming of hindrances, always put the joy together with it. That gives the true meaning. Is this a satisfying answer to you? Yeah, okay. Okay. I'll give you a difficult job. I relieve you of the job. Where do we go? You go. Well, I'm already happy to hear that you are familiar with how to deal with fear and sadness in the Vipassana approach. And I would guess that it's not so much different. But I'm a little bit ignorant of what the Vipassana teachers tell you of how to deal with that. So we have basically, when I teach of how to work with emotions, fear, sadness, whatever, we basically teach 5 steps. And I will use this opportunity to teach those 5 steps of working with emotions. Okay, you give me an invitation, yes? And that might be helpful. But I think it's not different from Vipassana. The first step is to stop, to make a pause before the emotional reaction starts, or while we notice that we are in an emotional reaction, to immediately pause with what we are doing, to get the foot into the door right before it slams. Yeah. So I notice I get angry. I notice I'm in pride. Yeah, this is the pause. First step. In the pause, this pause offers me a space in which I can see, oh, what would be helpful now? You know, what do I need? So this second step is called applying remedies. And for example, if it is pride, quick contemplation about the equal nature of everybody in the room, or quick remembering of, oh, all the qualities arise from Buddha nature, arise from the Dharma, or anger, quick contemplation about for example, what helped me a lot with anger was to contemplate that the other person, which makes me so angry, seemingly, of course I make myself angry, but that the other person is just as caught up in the emotions as myself, or maybe more, you know, quick. Like, so the remedies of the second step, they're usually quick reminders of some insights, or there are some kind of practice that we can apply in order for this emotion to dissolve. For example, remembering impermanence when I have desire, yeah, the impermanence of the object of desire, or also of myself. So many possible remedies. The third step is called transforming, but it means changing our view, transforming the view. And here, maybe in the Vipassana explanation, maybe these two steps, two and three, are not separate. You maybe taught them together. Transforming the view, for example, is that the problem situation, which makes my emotion arise, is actually a teacher. So it's not a problem situation more, but it's the guru visiting. So that's like a big change of view, of attitude in the situation. So the change of attitude, I'm sure you have been told about welcoming the emotion and taking it as a guru, taking it as some experience that instructs you. So that would be this kind of transforming the view. What can I learn from it? The teacher is visiting. Another transformation of the view, which is more particular, a Mahamudra style view, is in the situation itself, without applying remedies, without thinking that the teacher has come, to remember my Buddha nature. So we would remember, oh, I'm Tara. My extra nature is Tara. My extra nature is not anger. My extra nature is not pride. Yeah, we would. It's a complete transformation of self-view, which includes also transformation of the view of the other person. The other person is also Tara, is also Chenrezig, and so on. So that would be a transformation of the view which you would definitely not find in Vipassana. It's just an additional method, but a very powerful one, especially if one has trained in that. Because one first needs to train the method before one can apply it in a difficult situation. Now the fourth step, number four, is to look straight into the emotion. To look into the fear, to look into the anger. Looking means to feel into that area of my experience which feels most dense, where it feels like the most, like most probable that this would be the center of the experience. So maybe it's in the heart area, maybe it's an idea, and you would go into the center of that idea. So that would be looking directly into the emotion, and the point is to see the empty nature of the emotion. The point is that when one is truly feeling and looking into the center of the emotion, nothing is to be found. It's a very powerful method because it cuts the root of believing in the true existence of emotion. So I like to tell the story of this one retreat cook who was cooking in the 3-year retreat and practicing along with the group. It was one of the first groups I was guiding. And this guy, I still remember his name, I remember his tattoo on the forehead and so on. Strong guy. But from childhood on, every night he had the same nightmare. Every night he was pursued by an enemy and wakes up full of sweat and terrified. And he heard this teaching about looking into the emotions many times and wasn't quite able to apply it to the nightmare. But then came the day in the 2nd year of retreat when in the dream he was not running away anymore, but turning around, trying to see who or what was chasing him. Nothing there. He had looked into what was the most strong point of his fear, that which was chasing him from behind. Yeah, he looked into that. From that day onwards, the nightmare stopped. No such nightmare anymore. Just to tell you how strong that can be when you see that there is nothing there. It's an incredible experience. Yeah. So this is looking into the emotion. So how you do that, you need to find out. I was desperate with this instruction because I never knew how to look until it happened. And then it happened and then it was very convincing. And then to how to look is sometimes really a good way, but it's easier when the emotion is strong. To look into a weak emotion is not so easy. It's easier to look into the fear of a nightmare than to look into a slight anxiety which is lingering around. You know, this is difficult. Yeah? So just to give that additional instruction. And then the fifth way of dealing with emotions is called taking emotions as the path. But this is for those who have worked so much with their emotions that they have become very capable of looking straight into them, that they need more food. So then they put themselves on purpose in situations where emotions arise in order to have material to work with. So in order to see again and again the empty nature, the illusory nature of the emotion. That is the fifth one is for the advanced yogis. And when I was researching how this instruction is given in the Pali Canon, I can't give you the quote. I have it in my book, but it's I found a sutta or maybe even two where the Buddha talks about 7 ways of working with emotions. And when you summarize these 7 ways, then you come to the first 4, which I said. It's only the 5th one, which the Buddha doesn't talk about. Yeah. So I suspect that in the traditional Vipassana teaching, you would receive at least the first 4. Maybe not taking emotions as the path, because maybe one is not so interested to remain as a bodhisattva here in this earth. And then one needs to take emotions as the path. If one wants to be helpful here, one has to drop all hesitations with one's own emotionality and the emotions of others. One needs to say yes to that. Yeah. So this is the end of our questions and answers for today. Sorry for all those who couldn't ask their questions. Ready to sing the dedication? Yeah, the Sunam Diyi, the last 3 lines. Do you need light? You're close to the light over there. You can switch it on. Yes. Ui, luminosity. Yes, so I will explain the dedication prayer at a different moment, not now. Sunam de yin tam jazing panin top nen impenjanam pam jeneng kenga na jim palam jumpai simpen solen jovan javai shon jampem pavun jita kempadang. Kanto zampo de yang de sinte de da kunje je su da lom jeng ge wan de da tam je lam tu mo sang ye ko som ne pe jen lam dan che ne men ju den pe jen lam dan Gendu meche dumpe jen lam jin jin tang o wam en lam dumpai shu. And remember at the end of the dedication, no one has dedicated, no one has ever practiced, no identification. All is offered. Okay.